Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo. I'm back in the Pacific Northwest after a glorious trip to the beautiful state of Alaska. And I'm so excited about our guest today. Now, if you were looking up to see who is going to be on, I didn't have the opportunity to put certain information in. Russell Serra is my guest. His book is called Cry, Wolf, Cry. And as I've been telling you this past week, we're going to be talking about wolves. Now, Russell's book is a novel, but it's based on fact. And we're going to be discussing some things that I have learned recently, and I think you might find them interesting as well. Welcome to the show, Russell. So delighted to have you.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, Russell, you really have a passion for wolves, which I have an understanding about. Now, you are a former school teacher. You live in New York. You're married. You love cooking, gardening, the outdoors, and, of course, writing is really a passion of yours. But you fell in love with wolves. Now, a lot of people will have romantic notions about them, but this has been a passion where you've done a lot of research on this. What got you started? Why did these creatures of the wild appeal to you so strongly?
Well, Donna, I've been an outdoorsman all my life, and I love nature, and I love animals. I'm especially enamored of big animals, big mammals. And the wolf is so much like a dog, and I'm a dog lover. So I guess my interest in them stirs from my fascination with animals, especially big predators, and my love for dogs. Canids are my favorite animal on the earth.
Now, I know, because I've interviewed a number of people through the years that have had association with wolves, I'm very, very aware about the misinformation. And in your book, you do something very interesting. You talk about history. And let's do that, a little bit of that, because
about
history.
Okay.
And the history of the wolf. Now, in Russia, the wolf is demeaned terribly. Throughout Europe, there was a terror of wolves that was just unbelievable, so that they totally destroyed every single one that was around. And wolves are predators. We are predators. Human beings are predators. We are supposedly at the top of the food chain. It sometimes makes you question that positioning, but there is the reality that wolves serve a very significant part in nature. And I have just had the most interesting conversation since I reviewed your book, but the information you got on wolves in Europe in history, tell us a little bit about European history and why this ignorance and fear of wolves has prevailed through the centuries to such a point that people just feel that we ought to just slaughter every single one of them that's on the face of the earth.
Well, you know something, I feel very strongly that the hatred for the wolf, it was throughout Europe. If you understand your history, Europe itself doesn't have the vastness that the United States has in order to hold wildlife, and when history is there is nothing more than one war after another. I even mentioned in the book, after the Hundred Years' War, corpses were laid all over the earth. I mean, it was almost covered with human corpses, and the wolves had no game left, and they started to scavenge in order to survive. They fed upon these corpses, and when people saw that, they were really frightened to death, and you can't blame them for that. And from that point on, literature took over, and we have so much in literature that demonizes the wolf and says that he hunts for man. That's certainly not true. So when the our first ancestors came here, they brought that hatred and that fear of wolves with them. The American Indians lived with wolves for thousands of years in complete compatibility, and they got along fine with them, and the wolves didn't hunt for them. Mm-hmm. So I do believe the history of the wolf in Europe and the hatred that came here is probably the main reason why we disdain them so much and why people are so afraid of them and think that they hunt for us. They don't.
In 1926, in fact, it's the very first sentence in your preface in your book, the last great wolf in Yellowstone National Park was killed. And that is a very sad statement. Now, recently, they have been reintroduced into Yellowstone, which has caused all kinds of furor. But you make the statement that in less than two centuries, under 200 years, man had succeeded in eradicating 2 million animals from the North American continent in the most accomplished witch hunt of the 20th century.
Yes.
And that is a powerful statement. Now, mankind has been known for decimating, you know, animals on all levels. I mean, we had the pigeon that was totally wiped out. The buffalo was almost totally wiped out. We have so many species, the whales. We're doing that right now with our ocean.
Good Lord, yes.
And there are tens of thousands of species that have disappeared. The wolf is one that we're still having a war over today. And before we went on air, I shared with you that on my flight home, I was visiting with a lady who's from Montana. And about 3 weeks ago, there was a story about a rancher where 120 of his sheep were killed by wolves. Now, there wasn't any feeding on them, according to what she said. This was just a slaughter of 120 sheep. Now, I don't have the information. I don't have the article. I don't know who said what or what was said. But you had some interesting points to bring up about this, because is this something that wolves typically do, and lots of times these stories get blown way out of proportion. How can one find out the facts?
You know, Donna, if that were true, if it were true that wolves just killed wantonly, we wouldn't have wolves. They would eat themselves to death. Okay, they would destroy what they prey upon. Nature is a very delicate balance, and wolves, like I said, have survived. I think on this continent, the first wolves, as we know them, were here for 7,000 years. You know, that's 5,000 years before the birth of Christ. When man came along, when the Indians migrated here, they found wolves, and they lived in complete compatibility with them, and guess what? They didn't worry about wolves eating them or the game animals that the wolves preyed upon. The violence of nature, I believe, takes into consideration. The wolf is there to thin the herd. He will prey upon the weak of the animals. Now, I have done a lot of research, and there's a wolf almanac that I read, and one of the experts is a man by the name of Robert Bush. And he has something interesting in his foreword about that. Wolves will not kill more than they can eat. And so that statement really surprises me, because I just think the animal is conditioned by his own nature and by what he has learned not to kill wantonly. There's some kind of a clock inside of him that tells him, I can't do that, because if he does and the game animals dwindle, he will dwindle. And you know, I guess the balance does go back and forth, and I do believe that wolves will kill more than one animal if they can get their teeth on them. But since they hunt in a pack, and since it takes several wolves to take down the type of animals that they hunt ungulates that are bigger than they are. It's almost impossible for a single wolf to kill a caribou or an elk or a moose.
Mm-hmm.
It takes the whole pack. So in order to kill something like that, it's not an easy task. Now, for a wolf pack to just go and kill one sheep after another, I just don't think that's possible. I just don't see the substantiation in her statement. I really don't.
Well, it would be very interesting, and if any of you listening are in the area of Montana and you've heard anything about this, I'd love to know more about the exact circumstances. If these were free-range animals, if they were inside of pens. I mean, you can have renegades that occur in any species of animal, human included, that will go out and do certain things, but usually the pack is a very tight family unit, extremely tight family unit. Now, I want to bring up something else that came up this past week. I just love the synchronicity of things when they occur.
Mm.
I had been reminded by my husband about a dinner meeting that we had been at, and one of the people that was at this meeting was involved with Wolf Haven, which is here in the Pacific Northwest, and it's a wonderful facility, and they are all about educating people about wolves. And in the course of the dinner we were enjoying, it came up in the conversation that in the state of Alaska that there had been a major killing of wolves, and it had been done in such a way that they were just traumatized and that a bill had been signed to allow for this killing. Well, when I was in Anchorage, I asked some people about it, and they said, yes, we remember something about it. Let's look it up for you. So they did. And they found some information on a particular website, and they went in and they said there was a bill that was passed by certain people in the state of Alaska giving permission to kill wolves, and they were going to kill up to 400 of them, or close to 400, and they ended up killing only 58. Something stopped them, and they said they can't find any more information. It's really interesting. They're not sharing too much more here, but it stopped at 58 killings. In the state of Alaska, they finally outlawed aerial killings because they were killing bears from planes using high-powered weapons, and they were shooting wolves down, according to a client that I talked with. They said, oh, they had machine guns. They were just shooting them down whenever they saw them. They just blew them from the air. So now that's been outlawed. When you have this kind of thinking, when there's a fear, and this fear, just this year, this all happened in May, what I was just talking about, this occurred because people said the wolves were killing off the moose, and the moose population was down. Now, anyone that knows anything about moose and caribou, you know that they change their locations. You know anything about the Indians, they'd often have to go out and hunt them and find out what route they were taking or where they had gone, because they're moving the direction that enables them to get food. So the wolves, usually, if they know certain migration patterns, will stay along those patterns because that gives them an opportunity to kill to survive. And if they don't meet up with the migrations, they starve to death. But here you have this situation, and we really are at a critical point because more and more of us are becoming informed about these things, and more people are speaking out against allowing this to be done. But how can we get past this ignorance, Russell? I mean, it's really very, very complex, like you said, the natural balance in nature.
You know, Donna, even some of the information that was given to you, it conflicts with what I've heard. First off, the wolf was protected by the federal government for many years. And he was on the endangered species list. He was removed. The gray wolf was removed from federal protection last year, or the beginning of this year, early.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that happened, that gave the states the license, so to speak, to go out and hunt wolves again legally. Now, in Alaska, there is no bill that I know of that prevents aerial killing of wolves. As a matter of fact, Sarah Palin was viciously attacked by people who knew that she was allowing that in her state. And that is, that's something that's going on now. Montana will follow, Idaho. Idaho issued 14,000 permits to kill wolves as soon as they went off the endangered species list.
Good.
Now that
gracious.
Is the state, I'm sorry?
I said good gracious.
Yeah, good gracious is right. 14,000 and they're not even that many wolves in the state. But obviously, they just, what they want to do is eliminate the animals completely. They just want to annihilate them. They don't want them there. And, you know, you mentioned something else about wolves killing, the moose. It's amazing that, we've had millions more wolves than we have now. Before the last one was killed in Yellowstone in 1926, wolves ranged from coast to coast,
mm-hmm.
and there are plenty of them up north in Canada, but Minnesota is the only state that had any wolves at all left, and those wolves were here, and so were the moose. Now, when the professional hunters go out and they want clients to come in, especially in a place like Alaska, Alaska depends, I think, an awful lot on its income from professional hunters who go in. These are the people who are killing the wolves and the caribou, as killing the moose and the caribou. The wolves, sure, they'll take their share. But in this economy, a lot of hunters aren't going. They're not hunting anymore because of economics. And what these professional hunters are doing is they're saying, oh, well, we're not getting any hunters because we don't have any moose to hunt anymore. How come there were so many moose when there were so many more wolves here? Now there are just a few wolves and we don't have enough moose. Man is disrupting the balance of nature, not the wolf. But for political reasons, what we do is it's easier to blame the wolf. It's easier to say, well, if we get rid of the wolves, we'll have more moose. I just don't think that's true. In my research, I just can't find anything that would substantiate the fact that if we had wolves, we would not have moose or caribou or elk. In Yellowstone alone, the reintroduction of the wolf has helped the ecology there tremendously. In 1995, 1996, when they put the wolves back in, the whole park, the ecosystem of the park has changed for the better. And that's because of the reintroduction of the wolf. Yeah.
I think that there's such a misunderstanding regarding mm-hmm. predators, and because man has the capacity to produce weapons and do other things, not only do we prey on each other, but we destroy everything in the process. And your comment about European history and how, and you think back those hundreds of years, you think back that without wild game, very few people had an abundance of chickens running around in their yards. They didn't have commercial facilities that raised animals abundantly. And so it was whatever you could get. And once you decimated your rabbit population, your deer population, et cetera, then you have major problems. And in Montana right now, they do have a big issue, I guess, with deer, that there are so many deer that they are just come into town. And, of course, the city people are upset because the flower beds are destroyed. But they're not even concerned about people because they don't have anything preying on them. We have situations in Australia, many countries around the world, where creatures have been introduced and they have no natural prey, and consequently you can't keep them in balance. It's really a fascinating component, and I think the more you study nature, the more you see how predators, including human beings, there is a reason for things being done. But as humans, we have to be able to realize that just destroying something totally doesn't mean it's going to make the world any better. And we found that out in so many instances with pesticides creating superbugs, and there's a list that goes on and on and on. Do you see changes evolving, where people are becoming more consciously attentive? And what are you doing to make a difference?
Well, you know something? I live on Long Island in New York, and it's interesting that you mention that. We have in on Fire Island here, we have so many deer that it's becoming a very big problem. Several years ago, the state tried to call the numbers by it inviting archers, bow and arrow hunters in to kill some of the deer.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me. Several years ago, I wrote an article for Field and Stream. On Long Island, the commercial fishermen are often telling us about being out in the Atlantic Ocean and seeing not one, two, maybe four or five deer trying to cross the Atlantic to get away from the people on Fire Island in the summertime. Now, when they tried to do this hunt, people came from all over. They were clanging pots and pans and trying to stop the hunt. We have people who are interested in wildlife and they want to preserve wildlife, but you can't mess with that balance. And once we don't have the predators, as you say, the balance gets out of hand. And the deer problem in New York is devastating. There are more people getting actually auto accidents, people getting killed. Lyme disease is rampant mm-hmm. on Long Island. Mm-hmm. And that's because people just don't understand that balance. What am I doing? What I'm trying to do in my book, more so than anything else, I'm trying to make people aware that there is a need for these predators. Save the primates. I don't think there is another animal on the face of the earth like the canids. They are so much like we are, Donna. They are compassionate. They show love. They show fear. They are attentive to their young.
Mm-hmm.
They have loyalties. They're so much like us. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted people to be aware that this animal that they're trying to destroy is necessary in our ecology. And I don't think for a minute that getting rid of the wolves is gonna help us in any way. Yellowstone's better for the reintroduction.
Mm-hmm. Well, your story, Cry Wolf Cry, I can tell you there were certain parts that I had tears in my eyes because I could relate to so much of what you were expressing. And for those of you that would enjoy a story about the wolves, and you have Dakota, you have Bartok, you have, those are the names that he gave the wolves, but you have so many points of information that through this novel you are able to present, and I think that you do such a good job that you also have a bit of a love story in here. You bring in conflicts, belief systems, and all of this, I think, is very, very significant. And then, towards the end of the book, you give more information about the primary characters that you have written about. And it is really very, very moving. And obviously, you have a passion for this, and you have put your heart into this material, and it's very well done.
Thank you.
With the information on the Nez Perce tribe that you have in there, you talk about so many aspects of how they lived with different things and how a particular individual that you have based your story on has been very much involved in wildlife management and almost died because people beat up on him since he wanted to support the wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And you give a number of points of information. And you talk about the one wolf, Yuma, who is just an absolutely fabulous wolf. And he lived to be 11 years of age. What's the average age for a wolf in the wild? 7 or 8 years?
Well, if you put the puppies in there, the wolf pups, mm-hmm. it is about 3 years, Donna, believe it or not. Many of the young wolves don't make it. But if you're talking about how long a wolf could live in the wild, mm-hmm. I believe in my research I found about 6 to 9 years, mm-hmm. anywhere in there. An 11-year-old wolf would be unusual, although it can happen.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on his pack life. It depends on his status in the pack. As you may have read in the book, wolves are, when they're attacking a big animal like an elk, they put themselves in great danger.
Mm-hmm.
A beta wolf and an alpha wolf, these are the hunters. If you have an omega may stay back by the puppies, and an omega may live longer than an alpha or a beta, who are the hunters, because they don't put themselves in such jeopardy. They're the babysitters of the pack.
Mm-hmm.
However, these wolves are the ones that have the hardest life, because they're the last ones to feed. They're the wolves that are picked on by pack members. And sometimes they have to live on the fringes of the pack, because that's their nature. And so I think wolves are, it's amazing how they take care of themselves and how nature does this. So yeah, to answer your question, I think 11 years would be unusual. About 6-7 years would probably be how long a wolf could possibly live in the wild.
Now, Russell, what is the website that people can go to find out more about your book, Cry Wolf Cry, which, again, for those of you listening, it is covering a lot of the things that we are discussing, but it's a story about wolves, the conflicts that are about them, the fears, and a lot of what we've talked on about is in the material itself. But what's the website, Russell?
Well, the website that I have now, I'm going to change it. However, it's outskirtspress.com. It's outskirtspress.com/crywolfcry.
Outskirtspress.com. /cry wolf cry. If you're a lover of wolves, if you really love life and the sense of wildlife, and you feel that we need to become better educated, I think that this is material you would thoroughly enjoy reading. It also would give you a resource of information. And as you can tell, he is really quite knowledgeable about a lot of things. I didn't realize that the gray wolf had been taken off the endangered species list this year. So all of these different points of information I think you'll find fascinating. So go to his website, outskirtspress.com/crywolfcry. And I want to thank you so much for being with us. Do you have some closing thoughts you'd like to share with us before we say goodbye?
Yes, I would hope that since my book is a print-on-demand book, it is available in on Amazon.com,
mm-hmm.
or Target.com or BarnesandNoble.com, and that probably would be the best way for people to get the book. And if they were to log on and they could read my reviews, I have about 26 great reviews on the book, and I'm so proud of them. And if your audience would be interested, and they would just log on to Amazon.com, type in my full name, because there are so many books about wolves and Cry Wolf, so on and so forth. If they were to type in Russell M. Serra, they would probably be it would be easier for them to look up the information, see my reviews, and perhaps purchase the book. I'd love that.
Well, Russell, it's been a delight. And by the way, his last name, Sarah, is C-E-R-A. See, like Charlie, E-R-A, for the correct spelling there. Russell, thank you so much for being my guest today. It's been a delight.
Donna, thank you. I appreciate your interest in my book, and I enjoy talking with you.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. When we come back, we'll have more good things to share with you. Back in the Pacific Northwest, where the temperatures are dropping, yes, the heat wave is gone. We now are in the full force of fall, and golden leaves are waving in the winds of change. We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to DTaP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Hi, this is Donna, and our telephone lines are now open. That's right, and if you'd like to call in and chat with me, I'd love to hear from you. Telephone number is 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, if you're a first-time listener, all you need to do is give me your first name or initial, and, of course, I'm delighted to find out where you're calling in from. And then after that, if you'd like a reading from me, just sit back, relax, I'll give you my impressions, and then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that you would like. If you would like to comment on our subject today about wolves, I know that the engineer Don, who was listening to the interview, he was talking about how he owned a wolf at some time, so his story was quite interesting, and I've interviewed people through the years. One was a woman that went on skis to the pole, and she had a dog that was given to her by a Native American that was up in Alaska, or in the Yukon area, excuse me, and he said, if you don't take this with you, you will not make this journey, because she was going all by herself, and her story is just incredible. It was a wolf that had been trained, and I think it had part dog in it, I'm not sure. But the Eskimos would not treat dogs very nicely because they were there to be watchdogs. So she and Charlie, that's what she named him, Charlie became her best friend, and he was a wonderful watchdog, and he saved her life more than once. He saved her from polar bears, and polar bears don't like wolves, don't like dogs. And so she and Charlie, her adventure was just absolutely amazing, and she said that they then took Charlie. She and her husband did a lot of research on wolves, and they went up into an area of Canada near the Yukon, and they found out things about wolves since Charlie was part wolf. She was told by the Native Americans of Canada, that the taking of Charlie would probably enable them to get close to wolf packs because he was part wolf. And that is what happened. And because of having Charlie with them, they were able to observe wolf packs for, I believe, a couple of years. And they were there long, long time. In fact, they had to go so far inland that they had to backpack everything in. It was quite a rigorous expedition, if you will. And they were thrilled with it. And one of the things that came out in their research, which absolutely amazed them, is that there was a very compatible relationship between crows, ravens, and the wolves. And more than once, they found that the crows would let the wolves know where there was a kill, either an animal that had maybe been taken down by another predator, or maybe was sick and was dying, and that carcass was going to be available. And what they found in their research was the wolves would be able to understand what the crows were communicating to them. They'd go out, they'd find the carcass. Now, crows cannot chew on bones. They will peck at the meat, but they like the marrow of the bones of a downed animal. So the wolves, when they would feed, they would crack the bones, leaving the marrow exposed, and then the crows could feed on that. So, well, there's a lot of things that have been learned recently because of people's curiosity. And I think it's so important to understand that life has so many shades to it. And as my guest Russell brought out, they had been lived with by Native Americans in North America so comfortably and so easily for a long, long period of time. But fear is a component. So once it's introduced, it often blinds one to perhaps options and a willingness to learn and to observe. With fear, ignorance and superstition then have a tremendous foothold. And when someone can focus on that and pound that into you over and over and over again, you believe that it's real, and it isn't really. And one of the things that I think is pretty terrific about today's world is the fact that so many people communicating with each other via technology. We're finding out a lot of things that were given to us, force-fed us in the way of historical information, etc., that was not true. And more is going to be coming to the forefront. And I think that is one of the blessings that comes with the Internet, along with some of the headaches that we get with it, too. But really, being able to communicate with people from different places, how often do we question the information that we're given? Not often. If we find that someone has made a statement, and like I was sharing with Russell what I had been told, and then he pours out this information because he is researching it, he is really working with it, it's quite interesting. It's good to get different perspectives. It's good to find out where things evolve from and why things continue. There's an old story that I like to share, and it's timeless in its basis of wisdom. And there was a little girl watching her mom fixing a beautiful roast. Before she put the roast in this pan, the mother cuts off an end. And the little girl had seen this done by her mother more than once, but she couldn't understand it. She said, "Mom, I want to know why you cut off the roast." And she said, "Well, your grandma always fixed the roast this way, and I'm just copying her." Well, the time came when the little girl had a chance to visit her grandmother. She pondered the situation about the roast, and what her mother was doing didn't make sense. So she asked her grandma. She said, "Grandma, tell me why you cut off the end of the roast." And her grandmother said, "Excuse me, what are you talking about?" She said, "Well, when you fix a roast, Mama told me that you cut off the end of the roast every time you fix it. And that's what Mom does every time she fixes a roast." I wanted to know why you did it. Well, her grandmother just laughed really heartily. And she said, sweetheart, the only reason I ever cut off the end of the roast is that we were very poor and the pan I used was too small. How many times have we adopted something, accepting it as a tradition or a belief system, because someone that we love did something a certain way and never asked why they did it that way? Many times people continue to do things and they don't ask why, they just do it. It's comfort zone. We've gotten used to it. It's a routine. And when you can question it and you ask why you do something a certain way, you may find out that there actually is a better way of doing something than what you had ever anticipated. But you didn't question it because, well, that's just the way it is. It's good to question, and it's good to encourage children to question. And if you have kids around, no matter what their age, and if they say, this doesn't make sense, you'll say, right, let's do some homework on this. Get involved with them. Find out why it is you need to question certain procedures. This is evident in so many levels of life. Because of information, because of questioning, we are going to be forcing changes on so many levels. One, energy producing. People are out there trying a lot of things, but many times they're just trying to reinvent the same wheel, but just paint it a different color. Maybe make it a different size, but they've really not made a change. Healthcare. What about the positioning of wellness? You know, wellness. Are being responsible for taking care of ourselves. That's a different attitude. When so many generations were indoctrinated that you must depend on someone else for the information because obviously you can't think things through. There is a lot we need to be willing to challenge. I don't care whether it's politics, food, anything else. Don't be afraid to ask questions. And realize that there are as many variables as well as opportunities as well as negatives. There's always going to be this case. But if we educate ourselves, we're willing to be open to new concepts and ideas, examine them. Just because someone says that you should take 14 tablespoons of arsenic every day doesn't mean you should listen to them. For some people, it might give them a glorious complexion. You might, if you were another individual, you might die from it. So we need to really find out what's going on. Don't be afraid to ask questions. And I know I gave a ridiculous extreme example, but I think you get my point. Lots of times, one solution doesn't fit all. We need to have multiple solutions. And that's what makes life so exciting. So realize that you have an opportunity to be a part of this experience of life. Don't be afraid to question. Don't be afraid to make inquiries. Now, being in the psychic area for so many years of my life, it has been something that many times people will say, Donna, if you have this gift, does that mean it's absolute gospel? I said, absolutely not. It's an information. I'm an information resource. I give you what I perceive in the way of information. But it's up to you to think about it. It's up to you to evaluate it. And you have a right of choice. If you feel that there is another option and you're spurred on to go into a different direction, that's wonderful. If what you have received has enabled you to think differently, that's important because you have been given the capacity to think. That's what free will is all about. The sad thing is when we get into the blame game and we'll blame everybody and everything around us without recognizing that we have a positioning of responsibility of choice. And we can make choices. And we have to make it okay that that level of responsibilities is ours to enjoy. This is Donna Siebel. I know we're going on break in just a moment. Quickly before we do, I want to mention tomorrow we've got a fascinating topic. If you're into nutrition, which I am, we're going to be talking with Dr. Barry Tan about something I didn't even know existed, tocotrienols. Have you heard of them? Well, they are part of vitamin E, and what they are discovering, not tocopherols, but tocotrienols, they're discovering things that are enabling us to battle what otherwise has been considered a negative on so many levels. You have to listen tomorrow to find out. This is Donna Siebel. We're going to take a break. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat with me today. The number is 888-815-9756. We'll be right back.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedros. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Halloween is just 2 weeks away, and I don't know about you, but it's so much fun to be preparing for this, and people put on parties, and it's just a great event. And I came across a recipe that I thought, for those of you that might feel like you're going to be a hassled, harried hostess, why not pick something that's really good munchy stuff? And if you've got young people around, actually kids of all ages are going to like this. I am a real fan of Doritos. I love corn chips of all kinds, and when they're crispy and they're salty with cheese or whatever, it's just so good. But I came across a recipe, and it's a basic recipe, but it's going to add the color, and you're just going to have so much fun with it, and it's really going to be easy to fix, and you could fix a big batch of it and could even have all of the ingredients ready to zip out another fresh batch if you end up having a whole slew of people coming over. I know we're going to be attending a gathering where there's going to be maybe anywhere from, you know, 20 to 40 people attending. And that's a lot of people to feed, and munching for a Halloween party is really the best way to go. You want stuff that's finger food and kind of eaten. So I wanted to share this one with you because you could try it out at home really easily. And I think your friends and family would let you know how successful it could be. And you could doctor it up any way that you like. So what you're going to need is one can, a 19-ounce can of red kidney beans, and you want to rinse them, you want to drain them. And then you need one jar, about a 16-ounce jar of salsa, and of course, the spicier the better. You're going to need a tablespoon of lime juice, and I suggest using fresh lime juice. Squeeze it if you can, nuke the lime in your microwave maybe for about 10 seconds, and that'll help loosen up the membranes inside the lime itself, and you'll get more juice out of it. But a tablespoon of lime juice, you need a half a teaspoon of ground cumin, half a teaspoon of ground cumin. You need 9 cups of tortilla chips, your favorite. Now, I prefer a thicker chip rather than the real, real thin ones because they are going to hold up, I think, better for scooping. And then you want a jar of a salsa con queso, the cheese dip. You want a jar of the salsa cheese dip. And then you want a cup of jumbo pitted ripe black olives. Of course, you want to drain them and put them, you know, in a drainer, and then make sure you put them on paper towels because if they've already been pitted, lots of times there's excess moisture. So when you go to cut them up, you want to have them, but you want to be sure that you drain them so that they're not going to be adding excess moisture to this. And then you want 2 cups of your favorite corn chips, whatever they might be, and get them honey-flavored or barbecued, whatever is your preference. And, of course, you can get guacamole or fix your own. And then you want a tablespoon of chopped cilantro. Now, this is how easy it is. It's just so easy. You want to take a 12-inch pizza pan, and you want to line it with foil. And then you want to spray the foil with cooking spray. It just makes cleanup a lot easier. You put your beans, a cup of the salsa, the lime juice, and cumin. You want to mix them together and put them to the side. Then you want to take half of your tortilla chips, put them out over the pan. And again, I encourage you to get the thicker chip because it's going to hold up better. Top with half of the bean mixture that you have on the side, a cup of cheese dip, and then you need a half a cup of olives, a cup of your favorite corn chip, and a half a cup of your favorite salsa. Then you layer it again. You have your corn chips, your bean mixture, half a cup of your cheese dip, your remaining olives. Top it with more corn chips, the remaining salsa, and whatever you've got left over. You cover it with foil, and then you bake it for 10 minutes in an oven that's been preheated to 350 degrees. You uncover it, bake it another 10 minutes, and then put your guacamole all over the top of it and sprinkle it with cilantro and serve it piping hot. It'll be gone in 15 minutes. So you better have your assembly lineup of volunteers to keep the stuff going. This is going to be just as popular, if not more so, than a pizza. And it takes a lot less time. But, oh, is it good? It really is good. And if you like it spicier, you can make it spicier. If you've got young ones that don't want stuff spicy, then, you know, do a few substitutions. Just remember, you don't want a whole lot of moisture in it in the sense of, like, wet olives. You want to make sure those olives are pretty well drained. But it is so easy and so much fun and so quick and easy to fix. And it's going to smell just heavenly. And in our house, we love cheese. So that is something that we would probably add some more cheese to that. Of course, if you have it pre-grated, then that's easy enough to sprinkle on. But it's just so easy to do, and people will like it. It really is going to be popular. If you want to add meat, you can add meat. But this is great because if you have vegetarians, they're going to like it. People that are non-vegetarians are going to like it. So it's a win-win for everybody. Donna Sebo here, and if you want to give me a buzz, call me at 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Remember, all I need is your first name or your initial, and then after that, I like to know where you're calling from, and then sit back and enjoy what I give you in the way of information, and if you have any questions, you can ask that too. I have some stories in front of me that I think are pretty special. When times get tough, people come up with the most innovative ways to acquire whatever it is that they might need. Maybe they trade or they barter, but they also share. And I think sometimes it's tough times that make us realize how absolutely versatile and adaptable we really can be. And that there is an abundance in life that can allow us to give the best of what we have. There is a woman, Kay Watley. She's in North Carolina. She said she and a friend were having lunch one fall day, and they were talking about the economy and various communities that were around them that were having a tough time with their food banks. Kids weren't able to get food in schools like they had been before, and a lot of families were hurting. There were massive layoffs. So she and a friend were talking about this, and her friend said, it's just too bad that people don't share more with each other. And of course, her thought was, gee whiz, maybe it would have been better if I'd been a farmer. Interesting thought. Well, most of us are not going to be in a position to be farmers. So she decided she would turn on her computer, and she was getting a lot of ideas. She was sitting at the computer, and all of a sudden, things started popping into her head. And she said ideas were coming just as fast as she could type. And she started asking some questions. What if she got seeds at a local nursery and grew them until they were hardy enough to give away? Anybody could come and get a starter plant, and they had to make a pledge that whatever came off of that plant, they had to share the harvest. And she said, before I knew it, I ended up having a blog. So in a blog, she said, she put out a request, seeds and gardening tools, please. If you have them and you don't use them, I'd love to be able to utilize them. And she posted this request on every site she possibly could think of. Do you know that it wasn't very long before she started getting packets of seeds? People were sending them to her. She put her contact information in. There were friends and neighbors in the local area that lent her tools, and somebody had even offered to give her a bunch of old windows so she could make a greenhouse, and she didn't know anything about greenhouses. Well, her husband got involved, and he decided that he would help build a greenhouse. Well, here are all these donations that come in. They build a greenhouse, and I've got a picture of it in front of me. And she said it was within just a few months' time, they were nurturing about 2,000 plants. Now, in spring, when the weather got warm enough, they had picked a location when they were going to be giving away all of these plants. So she decided she was going to blog about it, and she put an ad in the paper. Do you know, the day that she started doing this, people lined up. They were lining up at 8:30 in the morning. By 12 noon, practically every plant they had been given away, and they had collected nearly 100 pledges from people in a town of 4,000. One pledge was done by a family, an entire family. They said they were going to take all of the food that grew from the plant and give it to a senior home that was in their neighborhood. Someone else wanted to grow vegetables for a women's shelter. And she said, one of the things that my husband and I pledged to do was to plant a garden. What happened is when the word got out about that, her husband's boss gave them 2 empty acres of land. And she said, we have been working on those 2 acres. And she said, it is amazing what's happening and what we have been able to share with people. I think that the human spirit is alive and well. Go for it. It's good. This is Donna Sebo. We're out of time. My goodness, I'm just zipped right along. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You take care. We're going to be talking vitamin E tomorrow. See you right here on bbsradio.com. Same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.